The second case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Barry Glenn Thunder. Mr. Ryan Kolbeck from the Minnehaha County Public Defender's Office for Mr. Thunder and Mr. John Stroman, an Assistant Attorney General for the State of South Dakota. The court would like to welcome once again the students from Northern, and also we understand we've been joined by students from Faith High School, and welcome to you also. Mr. Kolbeck, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court and counsel. When I was walked in, I was just handed a cell phone, and the officer at the door gave it to me, and he told me that it was your phone. And he told me that there was evidence of a crime on that phone. And I looked and I could see evidence of a crime on that phone. How far can I go into your cell phone and search for the evidence of that crime? How far could that police officer search into that cell phone in search of evidence of a crime? Right now, Officer Flogstad had no guidance from this court or any court as far as what he did and should have done and should do when he received a cell phone. This court, in this case, will provide guidance to law enforcement, prosecutors, defense attorneys, this state, and a lot of other states, because this is a new issue of how these cell phones are treated when officers hear or learn of evidence or maybe even see evidence on a cell phone. For three reasons, these videos should be suppressed in this case. The first one is that when Officer Flogstad hit play, he was investigating a child pornography, potential child molestation case.
Let me stop you there because you say when he hits play. What did he see, though? We all know that we have cell phones that have these that have the capability of playing these movies, that there's a picture there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beginning of the movie. What did he see at the very before he pushed play? Was there evidence of child pornography visible when he in that picture?
He saw four thumbnails. One of the images, I believe, in the top right corner was too blurry to really make any determination of what was on there. The other three had images that may have indicated or possibly did indicate child pornography.
So yes. Why is that not in plain view?
That is in plain view. And similar to the Opperman case, evidence that would be seized in plain view could have been seized. These thumbnails are not what I'm asking this court to suppress. These thumbnails were the result of a private search and would be admitted into evidence. But what was behind the thumbnails, further search.
Let me just understand, because I mean, if an officer sees something in plain view, you see a photo album and in the front of the photo album is a picture of child pornography. Mm-hmm. You're saying that the officer can't pick it up and look at the other pages in the photo album because all he sees is the first picture?
The main difference between a photo album and that hypothetical and this case is that this case involves a cell phone, which holds a lot more private and personal information. This holds the most private and personal paper in effect of any of us, that any of us have, can be in a cell phone, which is different than a photo album, which would be limited to just what's in the photo album. When you go further and you look into a cell phone, and that's why I think cell phones are different than the photo album, or if they look on top of a gym bag and you see
there should be a special recognition in our constitutional analysis for cell phones as opposed to other things that might be in plain view, like a bag of cocaine or something else.
I believe so. When you look at a cell phone, you know, a lot of cell phones have a wallpaper, kind of an image that can be on the very front part of that cell phone. I like to think of, in this case, the analogy is that the wallpaper of the cell phone is the front door of my house. What is in that cell phone is the same thing that's in my house. When you look at the different components of a cell phone, it's actually inaccurate to call a cell phone solely a cell phone and only a cell phone, because most of these objects have the immense technological components that can do so much more. For instance, a calendar feature, which is similar to the calendar that's in my kitchen in my house. There is the answering machine, which is in my kitchen in my house, which is also on my cell phone. You could also have emails, text messages, which are similar to the mail that's sitting on my kitchen table in my house. You have a photo album, as Justin Koenigkamp mentioned, and a cell phone, which is also in a house. And you also have what potentially could be a DVD or VHS collection in your house, which is similar to what could be a television or a video collection on a cell phone. Certain cell phones you can download movies and you can download television shows upon. These are way different than other compartments or other objects within the Fourth Amendment. I can't think of a personal thing that I could have in my house, paper or effect, that I could not put on a cell phone. There's so much information. When you looked at cell phones can be easily compared to computers. And the Kansas Supreme Court has noted in Rupnik in 2005 that a computer is a digital equivalent of the owner's home. So the same protections to of a cell phone, the same protections afforded to a home should be afforded to a cell phone. Just this last week, this court in the Deny decision noted that the utmost protection under the Fourth Amendment is afforded to a home. However, you know, in that case, the community caretaker allowed the officers to go in to provide aid, but it still notes the policy of the home and the utmost privacy interests of that home.
So you're saying a cell phone has the same constitutional standing as my house?
It can, Your Honor, yes. It's basically, it can be considered a mobile house. You have the same things, that the compartments within a cell phone, very similar to the compartments within your house. You've got a lot of different things in your house that are now in the cell phone. I don't have an answering machine at my house anymore because I don't have a landline at my house anymore. The cell phone has encompassed that.
It's like a diary. It's like all your personal thoughts and communications, everybody you talk to, it's all there to be opened. And, of course, people don't like their diaries to be read.
It would offend me if somebody came into my house and looked at my diary.
Well, I'm curious. You said you seem to concede, maybe I misunderstood you, that when the officer just looked at the pictures, the initial pictures, the thumbnails, he saw evidence of child pornography. So there's the evidence. Well, how is your client prejudiced then by just having more evidence by playing those movies when you're conceding that there was the case, he had child pornography?
Mr. Thunder was convicted of 4 counts of child pornography, possession, manufacturing child pornography, and 1 count of rape with a child of below in that age. The video, the jury determined, one of the videos contained that rape.
Okay, so the rape is really, he had to play the movie in order to have evidence of the rape.
Absolutely. You know, and I think it would be appropriate for this court to come back and to remand it for determination of whether or not those thumbnails constituted child pornography for a jury determination. Because we don't know from the jury's verdict of whether or not they just saw the thumbnails and thought that was a pornography, or with whether or not the actual video, the 10 to 15 to 20 second videos behind the thumbnails, constituted the child pornography.
Well, now, this phone had not been purchased by your client. It actually came into his possession from his sister, correct?
That is true.
Does that lessen his expectation of privacy since it wasn't his phone?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. If you look at United States versus Finley, actually, there's South Dakota precedent on this, too, before. And it's State versus Anderson, 1996, South Dakota 59. It's not in my brief, but I in paragraph 13.
Wait a minute now. Our rules say if you cite a case not in your brief that you I have to furnish copies to the court and counsel, but go ahead.
Well, they note that ownership is not the only factor. It is one factor, but not the only factor for reasonable expectation of privacy. The Finley Court cited in the brief in 2007 for the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, talks about how a person, and this is where an employer had purchased a cell phone for an employee, and it was a search pursuant to arrest for methamphetamines. And the employee, the court determined, would still have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that phone from both the public and the government. He has the right to exclude others. In this case...
Even if he stole it?
It's I don't know about stolen is maybe a different, a tough word here. Because,
well, taken without permission.
Sure. And in this case, Jessica knew that he had it. Oh. There was evidence that Jessica had been in the room, had seen the phone, and had not taken it back. So I would think that she actually acquiesced her expectation of privacy or her right to that phone in it. And
Mr. Kolbeck, the intervening family members taking the phone back, activating it, I mean, the father activated it, gave it to another son who looked at it, family members looked at it, they're not police actors, and then they gave it to the police. Doesn't that affect a reasonable expectation of privacy and the protection under the Fourth Amendment?
In this case, it would be Mr. Thunder's expectation of privacy to look at, and subjectively, he left that phone.
Mr. Thunder, you mean father?
I'm sorry, yes. My client, Mr. Barry Thunder. Not the father, the individual whose bedroom it was found in, and the individual who stayed in the locked bedroom that it was found in. When he left that place, the room was locked, along with his other duffel bag, television, and other clothes.
Well, did he have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the room when the police threw him out at the request of the owner, his mother?
You know, when he left, actually one of the things that he mentioned to Detective Koischer when he was interrogated was that he was planning to go back to that house. You know, I'm not exactly sure what he knew when he was leaving. However, the landlord coming in there and evicting him would not have followed the normal landlord-tenant law type of procedure as far as a three-day notice to quit for a forcible entry type of process. If he did not think he was going to come back to that room, I don't know why he would have locked it if he was abandoning everything that was in that room. He had other personal items in there. He didn't make an effort. There's no evidence that anything else was in any other part of other items or other objects that he had was in any other place, like he had been moving. Subjectively, I think he has an expectation of privacy. When you look at it objectively, you have the phone with especially on these videos, which being on the memory card of the phone, they were not accessible to any transmission carrier. Some of the cell phone cases make a distinction between, you know, the text messages that are sent out or the incoming and outgoing calls, because Verizon and AT&T or Altel could see that. You know, these were on the memory card of that phone and nowhere else. It wasn't activated, so it could not have been anywhere sent to any place, anybody else. He could not have and did not relinquish that expectation of privacy by having anything leave this phone. The deny case cites it was the Rohrig, I'm sorry, I think that's it, decision where the home, the owner of the home, relinquished an expectation of privacy by playing loud music to a certain degree. We don't have that similar thing here, where he relinquished any expectation of privacy from this phone in any way that he operated that phone.
What about the police officer? And this is an exclusionary rule to deal with police misconduct. When a police officer is handed the phone by someone in possession and saying this is, giving it to him and saying, here's what's on it. Why isn't the police officer able to rely on what they were told in looking at that phone?
They are able to rely on what they're told, but I would suggest that they need to get a warrant based on that information. It's tough for Officer Flogstad in this situation when he is 29, 30 years old with 5 or 6 years of experience, and he's basically handed a phone and saying, look, there's evidence of a serious crime on here. I would feel compelled if I was that police officer in that situation to do what I can to see this evidence and then figure out what happened right on the spot. However, when you're dealing with the technology that we have, which is evolving, if I'm in that situation, I have a cell phone that's not connected to the internet, but however does have text messages and that type of thing. If I was handed a BlackBerry or an iPhone that I don't know how to operate, I may do something wrong when I'm actually looking into that phone for the evidence. Officer Flock said, I don't know what his experience was with cell phone or with iPhones or the BlackBerries or anything, whatever's coming next. But he may, and actually, have done something wrong with that phone while thinking that he was investigating it. The preservation of evidence type of argument here, I think, actually weighs in favor of stopping and getting a warrant, rather than having a person who may not be fully aware of the capabilities of a cell phone going through it, because this evidence could have been lost. Now, we don't know what the cell phones of tomorrow are going to have, but if an officer is handed evidence on some kind of unit and it starts playing around with it and searching around with it, we may not know, and that evidence could be destroyed. He could rely on what he received to get a warrant, and then the magistrate or judge would determine a determination of whether or not he can go and where he can go. You know, in this case, I think the judge would be right in saying that he can go to the videos. But I don't think he should be right to be able to go into the calendar feature, the calls, a lot of the other different things that are within a cell phone.
If he doesn't have the right to look at the phone, what's his probable cause to get the warrant?
Would be based on the images that he saw on the thumbnail and the testimony of Jessica and Sonny of what they saw earlier.
Okay.
Who actually handed the phone to the officer?
Jessica Longcrow at the hospital.
And in some, does the evidence indicate that at some point in time that her name was associated with that phone?
Yes.
So why is this different than joint possession, where one joint owner can give permission? If two people are in an apartment, one can give permission to search the apartment. Why is this dissimilar from that?
Right about the time that Officer Flogstad received the phone from Jessica, and I think in his testimony he said at about the same time, he learned that it was Barry's cell phone. And Jessica told him that it was Barry's cell phone. So I think with her making the distinction that it's not mine, it's his, would no longer agree to the joint possession or potentially consent that she gave in this case. You know, this is a tough case, and I think it's a groundbreaking case for this court to do. When this opinion is reached, there, as we know, there aren't very many cases on this issue. When you look at Walter and Jacobson, the most recent case would be 1984, dealing with a private search. And I doubt in 1984 that they were thinking about these cell phones and the immense personal information on it. One of the fears that I have is that the content here is a tough case. But the Fourth Amendment is not content-based. It does protect all papers and effects from unreasonable searches and seizures. And these papers and effects in this phone, just like your phone and my phone and every other phone in the state, is important. It has all the personal information that we own or that we possess can be on a phone. When you look at Jacobson and Walter, as I guess the two main United States Supreme Court cases here, this search is more like Walter, where this was a significant intrusion on the privacy interest. It was more than a field test, which is not a search, and it the displaying of the videos and watching never seen before footage as far as the private party is concerned is similar to the agents in Walter who put those 8mm videos on the reel and watched them. When Judge Nielsen, in his opinion, wrote that Officer Flogstad opened up the phone and went into it and hit menu, and I know there's some evidence as far as what happened there, but it's similar to going and putting the 8mm reels on the projector and watching it in Walter. It's different as far as a privacy standard. Both Walter and Jacobson, the individuals, basically relinquished most of the expectation of privacy that they have by giving these objects to the U.S. Mail, FedEx, or the other freight carrier, and sending it across the country. Barry never did that.
Well, you know, you claim it wasn't stolen. But what fact, is there an undisputed fact regarding the status of his possession? Was it unauthorized possession? Was it authorized? What is the status? Factually, it's undisputed with respect to his possession of the phone.
What's undisputed is that he never purchased the phone. I don't think he was a part of the original family plan group that purchased the phone. And I don't think at any time, you know, that the phone was ever activated, Barry ever used it in that or had it. He was using it as an alarm clock. Jessica knew that he had it, and Jessica did not get it back. The other individuals weren't looking for it as far as it goes. I guess, you know, when you think of whether or not it's stolen, there weren't any police reports reported from anybody here in the family member. I can think of hand-me-down clothes where I've been wearing my brother's jacket for the last 5 years. It's basically mine. He knows I have it, and he hasn't asked for it back. When you have a family plan, I have a unique situation where my phone was, I got my phone a couple years before my parents did. And my phone is the original phone through Verizon. My parents have added onto my plan. Now, whether or not I can go into their phone, I don't believe I can. And if you ask them, they probably wouldn't care because it's me. But the fact is, they don't think that I could tell other law enforcement or other individuals that they could go into other phones within a family plan. I think it's similar to that effect. I believe my 20 minutes is
yes,
up.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Mr. Colbeck.
Thank you.
Mr. Stroman, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Please, the court, counsel. I see this case as much less of the philosophy of cell phones and more directly a fact-driven determination with reference to the Fourth Amendment. The state cited the Supreme Court case of Katz, where it talks about the reasonable expectation of privacy. Appellant himself cited Cordell v. Weber, and one of the factors with reference to the reasonableness of the expectation of privacy was a factor as to whether society was willing to honor that expectation as being reasonable. I think that's very important. The appellee cited State v. Cundy in our brief, and in that sets forth the various exceptions to a warrant, one of which was consent, plain view, which the state would like to address a little later. But I think most directly with reference to this case is the issue of a search by private individuals who are not operating under color of state authority. And, of course, color of state authority would be such where a police officer sent a private individual in essence as a surrogate for themselves to conduct a search. That did not happen in this case. Justice Sinner talked about the specifics of the evidence as to the phone, this whole area. I think those factors are incredibly important in determining whether or not a reasonable expectation of privacy exists. And I think it starts in this particular bedroom or sleeping room in which he was at. And the state will be making reference to mostly the suppression hearing, pages 9 through 14. First of all, appellant did not have a key to this bedroom. Yes, there was a lock on the door, but he used a coat hanger to pop the door open. Three or four different occasions, both his father and stepmother had demanded that he leave the residence. His stepmother had specifically said for him to pack his stuff and get out permanently, suppression page 11. Thunder did not have a lease, nor did he pay rent. When he refused to leave, both his father and his stepmother contacted law enforcement to have him forcibly removed. He was, the police did show up, they went down there, they told him to leave, and Thunder was permanently removed. He didn't take this phone with him. Whatever property interest he may claim to have, it was in essence abandoned there. Police advised the family then to lock all the windows and the doors. The very next day, Thunder, who obviously did not have a key to the home, broke in by breaking a window and getting back into the house, which resulted in the landlord then contacting law enforcement again, and he was extracted from the home, again leaving this cell phone in this room. At this point, no private search has taken place. It's actually 4 or 5 days later that family members go into this room to clean it out, and this phone is found. Now, next comes the factors regarding the cell phone itself. The phone was not purchased by appellant, suppression page 40. He never activated it. It wasn't activated for him. There's no subscription in his name. He was not given the phone by Sonny, who claimed an interest in it. Suppression, page 40. Possessory interest, he had none other than he took it. His sister testified, suppression 5859, that Thunder would come and take her property and put it in his room, so then she would go in and get it. Now, there seems to be an argument that, well, she saw it, and so she somehow acquiesced to it, or somehow there's adverse possession to this cell phone. Well, this was a common cell phone, and there's no place in the record that states that it was ever given to him or she acquiesced in that respect.
Well, did the trial court enter some findings of fact on who actually did own the phone?
The findings state that both her and Sonny seem to claim a possessory interest in it. That would be the half-brother.
Well, did the court then, on the other, conversely, did the court find then that Mr. Thunder did not have a possessory interest in it?
I don't recall a specific finding to that effect.
So, I mean, you seem to be arguing the facts to us about who had a possessory finding, but, I mean, we're a reviewing court. If the trial court didn't make a clear determination about who had a possessory interest in it, how do we do that?
Well, I'm stating from the record, because I believe this is important when we are determining whether this was a private search or whether it was in plain view, a lot of these factors that are involved.
Say that when he was evicted by the officer and the parents, that he put the phone in his pocket and went out the door with it. Do we get a different result? It's on his person.
It's on his person. And law enforcement comes and takes the phone?
Yes.
There might be a different result.
Okay.
There might be a different result. With that...
I'm a little confused.
Yes.
What did the trial court find? That he didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy, or that he did?
No, they found that it was owned by the sister and the brother, that it was left in this room.
So it wasn't a reasonable expectation of privacy.
I don't believe there is a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Is that what the trial court determined?
That's what I derived from the opinion.
Okay, so it wasn't very specific. Is that what you're saying?
It wasn't real specific. What we do know is that Officer Flagstad testified that Jessica told him that there were pictures of her daughter being molested, and there was video as well. And that's the suppression page 72. Officer Cook testified that the cell phone was handed to Flagstad in an open position, despite the trial court mentions that it was closed and open by the officer. The state, as its main argument, is using the case of U.S. v. Jacobson. In that case, there was a damaged box that a private freight company received. The box had black paper in it. There was white powder seen in. There was damage to the box. The private company saw that. They saw a series of four plastic bags. They contacted DEA, and they put the bags and box back together. When DEA arrives, it removes the tube from the box, removes the plastic from the tube, saw the white powder, opened the bag, removed the trace powder, conducted a field test, and determined that they were illegal drugs. The U.S. Supreme Court stated they did not need a warrant before the testing of the powder, and the reason why is that there had not previously been anything learned that was new that didn't result from the private search. And the analogy to that is in this case that the record states that Jessica told the officer with an open cell phone that the pictures here of her daughter being molested and video as well in suppression page 72. The officer sees the thumbnails. And, of course, what are the thumbnails? It's going to be the first frame of a video, all right, which manifests itself as a picture. Officer Flagstad testified that the first thumbnail, he saw a girl lying on her back with no underwear, exposing her vagina with her legs open. The second frame, he couldn't see. The third one, he saw a bare buttocks, and a bare vagina. And the fourth one, said you look carefully, You can see the vagina.
And so he sees these when they just hand him the phone. He doesn't have to press any button or anything. They're just on the screen.
They are right there as thumbnails, which are the first frame of the video. He knew he was going to be looking at a video based on what Jessica told him. That's a trial transcript, page 132. So, and when you look on the trial transcript 122, Officer Cook states that Jessica gives instructions, we don't know what the details of, and an open phone to the officer. He sees these. And that's why I think it is important to not only look at this issue from the private search matter, but also from concepts of consent, which I think that's why it's very important. Who may, as a secondary issue, and who had a possessory right to this, or at least a legitimate expectation of privacy. And there's nothing in the record that gives defendant a legitimate right of ownership to this phone. We have the potential owner, at least the previous owner, being the sister and the other brother. The other brother brings the phone to the hospital at the sister's request. The sister herself presents it to law enforcement. There's an issue here that if you're going to talk about consent, all consent with reference to this particular item is granted by the sister. With reference to plain view, it would apply if the officer unlawfully, there'd be a problem with the plain view if the officer unlawfully had the phone. The officer did not unlawfully have the phone. The previous owners provided it, opens it up, sees the thumbnails there, and hits play. After knowing that there was videos on it.
Now, this phone wasn't activated at all by anyone at this time, right?
At this time, no.
So it's like a discarded phone that somebody else has picked up and used.
Well, the testimony we have from the sister is that defendant would go into a room and get various items that she owned, whether it be DVDs, CDs, and bring them into her bedroom.
So he wasn't really using it as a phone.
He obviously did with reference to he used it as a phone, no. But he used the phone as a camera, video, and alleged testimony that he used it as an alarm clock.
It would be like picking up your sister's camera and taking a bunch of pictures. Is that what he was doing with it?
Well, he wasn't authorized to have it. There's no place in the record that shows that he rightfully could use his phone or otherwise. He did have it. That's it. And he also, excuse me, Justice.
Well, at the point, that was true at the point that he had it, but the phone was activated at the point of the search, wasn't it?
At the time of the search, the father had it activated for the other son.
So there was a break from the ownership of Mr. Thunder, the father taking it, having it activated for the son and another son who had possession and found the pictures.
Yes, the son found the pictures. He himself gave it to his sister to show her because her daughters were involved. All right? So my point is that there is this continuum of rightful possession of people who gave this to the police officers. This is a private search issue. In addition, if there's a claim that there was an expectation of privacy or even some possessory interest by a defendant, it needs to be remembered that after twice that law enforcement forcibly removed him from the house, he left that phone there. Okay, so there's some abandonment if, arguendo, there is any expectation of privacy or right that he is claiming. The state's position that the facts of this case fall squarely into a private search. That those who brought it, and as the case law says, even if there's a wrongful private search, it doesn't matter. As defense counsel shared, the cases that he was citing involved governmental involvement in search. That's not what happens here. Okay? This is a private search. It's obtained privately. It is given by those who have an ownership or possessory interest in it to law enforcement with open cell phone showing them what is contained. It's obvious to law enforcement. It's child pornography. And they push a button after there are instructions and pushes a button and watches the video, confirms what they was told. It must remember, the sister said that the testimony of Officer Cook was that her child was molested. Okay, so there's nothing new that was gained. It wasn't the strictly new that there was this rape that was obtained by watching the video. This information was provided by the owner or joint possessor of the cell phone when she gave it to law enforcement. This is a private search. With that, consent issues or plain view, I believe, are secondary, but are also very legitimate in that the person who had the right to give consent did. And the officer saw this in plain view and acted upon it. And based on those reasons, the state maintains that there is not a violation of the Fourth Amendment and that the conviction should be upheld. Does the court have any additional questions for me?
It's not.
Thank you.
Nobody's ever chastised for quitting early.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Colbeck, and you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Regarding the ownership of the phone, Judge Neal's opinion states the number of different people who had, at one point in time, possessory interest. Darlene, the mother, opened the account and obtained three different cell phones. One was Sonny's, one was Jessica's, and one was the mother's herself, Darlene's. The account was no longer active, and basically the phones would not work. The evidence suggested that Barry was using the phone as an alarm clock, something that would work, even though the phone is not activated. Both Sonny and that they both testified, identified that they recognized that phone. And Jessica said that she had seen the phone in Barry's room. And then the rest of the paragraph ends with, none of the parties have raised the issue of ownership of the phone as an issue regarding the suppression motion here raised. So I don't think that Judge Neal has typically made a finding one way or the other regarding the ownership of the phone and the expectation of privacy in the phone. I would note.
So what did he base his decision on then?
He based the decision on Jacobson and the fact that hitting play was not a further significant intrusion.
It wasn't a private search. He didn't make that finding.
He made the private search finding up until the thumbnails, but that when he went further, it was unconstitutional.
You know, you emphasize phone, but in reality, we're talking about a camera here. Does that make a difference in your analysis? I mean, it was really only being used as a camera, and it's just like a digital camera. So really what he was looking at is he's looking at the little thumbnails and then goes back and looks at all the other pictures that are on that camera. Does that make a difference in your analysis?
To the extent that we know that this digital camera, I guess, being used, I would assert that even in a digital camera format, if you could see thumbnails, but on one screen, and that was given to an officer by a private party, the officer necessarily couldn't go potentially into the thousands of other photographs that are on that camera without a warrant.
But anybody can pick up a camera and take pictures. If it's my camera and I give it to the officer and say, look at here, somebody's been using my camera.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't I given him permission to go back and look through the pictures?
In a certain extent, but at the same time, you say that it's somebody else's camera. Like Jessica told the officer right off the bat that it was Barry's camera, or Barry's phone in this case, that Barry was using it. I don't think the officer then could go back and forward it into it. And a phone is different than a camera because, you know, this court right now is going to be, I don't even want to call it a phone. You know, these objects are different than ever been dealt with before. There's so much information that can be on these things. Where do you draw the line? Now that we're going to tell and instruct an officer, the exclusionary rule is to deter, but it's also to instruct. We're going to instruct these officers that they can go into, you know, what they know of right now, but not everything else, which is going to be hard when you're an officer on potentially the scene of a crime and you may have evidence and you're probably a little excited and you don't exactly know where to go. You know, I think that within the phone, I think that the court should draw a bright line rule here and say these officers, when they receive a cell phone, if private search, which I agree, this is about a private search to the thumbnails, that that's where they must stop. If they're going to go any further, they need to get a warrant. And then maybe learn a little bit about the phone before they go into that warrant, about the technology that we're going to be dealing with here. This is
Does your client have a reasonable expectation of privacy when he's forcibly evicted not once but twice from the house by both the family and the police, and he leaves the phone behind both times, and it was never his to begin with? Somehow yes. He came into his possession.
Yes, he does. By leaving it when he did leave in a locked bedroom, if he didn't have an expectation of privacy, the door wouldn't have been locked, and the rest of his clothes would not have been in that room. Whether or not he was forced to be left, I think he was arrested based on unpaid outstanding warrants and other effects. He wasn't arrested for trespassing here. You know, he was not arrested until that he was supposed to leave and then came back, which is the elements of an occupancy charge, and he could have been arrested for trespassing if that was the case. You know, this would have been, the landlord came in the next day and said, "I want him out of this house," as far as on the Saturday, the day later. And when Barry left that house, his belongings were still in that house. Everything that he basically owned, I don't know of anything that he owned that was anywhere else, was still in that house, and particularly in that locked bedroom with everything else that he had. I would note expectation of privacy. Judge Nealis, in his opinion, talking about the private search towards the end, he does note that any expectation of that Barry Thunder had was defeated by the private searches of Sonny and Jessica. And I would note that I believe that goes to the thumbnails as far as that goes, because what the officer saw in plain view. But saying that he had whatever was defeated would give him, I think, logically, an expectation of privacy in the first place. So I do think that Judge Nealis did note that there was some expectation of privacy, or else the comment of any of it being defeated would have been irrelevant, would not have been needed. When you talk about whether or not the phone was open or closed when it was received by Officer Flogstad, Officer Flogstad, based on the suppression hearing, says that he doesn't know. Yeah, he doesn't recall whether or not it was given, when it was open or when it was closed. Officer Cook, at the suppression hearing, testifies to the extent of, well, from what I recall, the phone was open. And then at the jury trial, it was much more certain, saying that the phone is open, as far as that goes. But Officer Flogstad is not aware at page 81 of the suppression hearing that it is. He does note on page 129 of the jury trial, Officer Flogstad states that when answering the question, "What did you do when you received the phone?" he looked at the inside of the phone. You know, so I don't know for sure if that means he went into and hit buttons to look into the phone, and that's what Judge Nealis states. Judge Nealis, in his opinions, notes that Officer Flogstad hit the menu tab and went into the picture area.
Was it a folding phone, or was it one where you could just see the pictures right on the face of the phone?
It was a flip phone. One where if when it opened it up, it opens up and the screen's on top with the buttons on the bottom. Now, typically with a flip phone, the wallpaper could be on the front. And I think from Judge Neal's opinion, he stated that he had to go through and hit menu, tab, over, and then find the picture out, videos, and then go further. From what Officer Cook says that the screen was open and the four thumbnails were right on it when the officer received it. You know, this is the distinction that's hard right now. We're not going to know exactly what an officer receives from a private party when they receive a cell phone. That's why if the court would go with the bright line rule saying, well, the private party saw the thumbnails but nothing else, that's in a cell phone with this private information, as far as the search could go without a warrant. The discussion about how the officer received the phone is not necessary, because we know how far the officer can go. And I think in the future, when this court instructs the law enforcement officers and everybody else that's going to be dealing with these issues, we're going to know right off the bat where the line is as far the officers can go. We're not going to come down to decisions as far as, well, did the officer have to make 6 clicks or 3 clicks, or go into 4 menus further before he found what he saw, or was it right off the bat? We're just going to know exactly where he's at. Can he go into the calendar? Can he go into the message service, or can he go into the text messages? We're going to know where it's at. These phones are, you know, the technology is amazing. And you know, right now, this court is going to be one of the first ones to make a determination of where that line is drawn.
Well, but the Fourth Amendment isn't known for bright line rules. Generally, it goes on a reasonableness, which has a certain maddening context because one size doesn't fit all.
True.
So what does that do to your argument?
Well, Chief Justice, I thought a lot about whether or not I should say ask for a bright line rule, you know, because of the Fourth Amendment. Yeah, but I think when you're dealing with something that is so new as far as a cell phone with or these objects, we need to have something similar to that. Or else we're going to be in trial courts, suppression hearings back and forth, and we're not going to know where it is. You know, the case-by-case analysis is what I usually advocate for. You know, but, you know, right now I'm going to be advocating, and I think that this court should take the role and basically lead the nation and lead the country in this type of area of law of how far we can go with these personal informations. When you're looking at a home, which this is easily analogized to, you know, where is that line drawn? Is it drawn at the front door, or can you go into the front stoop, or can you go into the bedroom, or where you're at? You know, that's the type of thing where we're at here. You know, I think it needs to be drawn right at the front door of the phone, right at the front door of the home, and that being determined. You know, it's the easiest way right now at the beginning area of this law with the law following technology. We don't know where this is all going to go, but to start right now with a law that says you can go with a private search and no further is the best place to start. It's not going to be an easy decision right now, the content, but I do think that this is an opportunity for the court to do so. And that's why I believe that the suppression of the videos is important. Remand to the trial court for the thumbnail determination of whether or not it's child pornography.
Thank you, Mr. Colbeck. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.